My guest today is Dr. Joseph Hickey, who is born and raised in Peekskill, New York. Dr. Hickey graduated from the University of Notre Dame. He is a graduate of the New York Medical College, and his residency was completed at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine in the Bronx. In 2004, Dr. Hickey opened the Hickey Wellness Center, which is a primary care internal medicine facility in the incredible location of Hilton Head Island, South Carolina. In addition to providing primary care, Dr. Hickey is currently doing clinical research on various conditions, including fibromyalgia, multiple sclerosis, and hold on to your seats, Parkinson's disease. Dr. Hickey, thanks so much for being with us today on the show.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Robert. I'm looking forward to it. Neurotoxic metals contribute to many neurodegenerative disorders. A cousin of mine was given a diagnosis of myelodysplastic syndrome, which is a degenerative and almost universally fatal condition of the bone marrow, where he couldn't make blood. He was seen at two bone marrow transplant centers, one in Boston, one in New York, and another down here in South Carolina, where I got a third opinion. And his bone marrow just couldn't produce blood. You know, just reviewing his history, he was a plumber and he worked for a nuclear power plant. That was my only clue, that he was a plumber, and plumbers deal with lead pipes. And I said, well, John, I know lead toxicity can create anemia, and you have a severe anemia. Have you been exposed to lead? And he said, yeah, Doc, I had removed several lead pipes from this one facility in New York, and that was a year before he got sick. I said, well, if you have lead toxicity, then there's something called chelation, which I had never used. I'd never even thought of using, didn't know how to use 10 years ago. But I said, there's this treatment called chelation that could remove the lead, and maybe that's the only thing you could have that I could help you with. And so he got excited, I got excited. But the traditional measurement that I was taught for lead toxicity was to do a blood lead level and to do a 24-hour urine collection for heavy metals. He had very little lead in his blood. He only had 3 micrograms, and the average person has up to 10. And he had very little excretion from the 24-hour urine, so I got very disappointed and said, well, John, I don't think you have lead toxicity. And, of course, he was already psyched up to be chelated. And chelation dates back to FDA-approved EDTA chelation was 1951. Now, I had never thought to chelate a person for heavy metal toxicity because I've never found an elevated blood lead level. And so I assumed that that meant they weren't exposed to it. But with John, he begged me to chelate him anyway. And, you know, he said, look, I have nothing else I can do. I'm sure I've had a lot of lead exposure. I don't know why it's in the blood. So I started to chelate him. I learned how to do it. I started to chelate him. And within about 6 weeks, his bone marrow function returned to normal. So a light bulb went off in my head. We're measuring this wrong. There's got to be another way to measure it. And that led to some very interesting investigations. And that's what got me started on this. And then I started testing in the proper way neurotoxic metals. And they are so commonly present in Parkinson's disease and in Alzheimer's disease and in MS. You know, it's, the levels are ubiquitous in those diseases. So I started to remove them to see what would happen, and I started getting some clinical responses, and that's really how I started out 10 years ago.
What specifically was it that led you to suspect a connection between the symptoms of Parkinson's disease and heavy metals?
My neurology consults would always include a heavy metal analysis. So whenever I would send somebody to one of my colleagues in neurology who had a neurologic disorder, they would always do a heavy metal screen. So in that, that was particularly true for peripheral neuropathy. And really, for any neurodegenerative disorder, you have to consider lead and mercury, cadmium toxicity, aluminum toxicity. These are definite causes of neurodegeneration. We should go through some of the literature connecting those disorders and what those metals do to brain function. That was always included as almost a routine screen. The way we would screen for it, and the way that most neurologists if they even think of it, currently screen for it, is to do a blood lead and mercury level, blood aluminum level, and a 24-hour urine collection. But in 20 years of screening people for those metals, I never found an elevated level. Now, that means one of two things. Number one, that no one has toxicity from these metals and that we've kept the environment relatively pure of them. Because if it's in the environment, it's in us. We eat the food that comes out of the ground. We breathe the air. We breathe the dust that is in the ground. Most of us grew up during the era of leaded gasoline. So when you put lead into gasoline, tetraethyl lead came out of everybody's exhaust pipe, and we inhaled it. And lead and mercury are so similar in their chemical structure and positive charge to calcium, zinc, and magnesium that they are directed right into the bone and muscle and cells, just like calcium would be. So they're automatically attracted into the tissues. And that's why you don't find them in the blood, because they disappear within hours to days after exposure, and most of it are attracted into bone. Really, I started out very innocently with the idea, well, I know that mercury and lead are toxic to the nervous system, and now that I know how to measure it, now that I know how to tell what's in my particular patient, what would happen if I remove them? And that, I would see a clinical response. I would see an improvement in energy first. I would see an improvement in cognitive function. Parkinson's patients constantly fall asleep, and everything slows down. Their thinking slows down. Their movement slows down. You know, and that's electrical speed. Electrical speed is positive and negative charges being separated. So, you know, that's the way your neuron works. Your cell membrane is negatively charged. Calcium, zinc, magnesium, sodium, potassium, they're positively charged metals. And you have these little pumps on the cell membranes that separate the positive charge from the cell membrane, and that creates a tension because they positive charges want to meet a negative charge. They want to come together. So these cell membranes generate electricity by basically separating sodium and potassium and calcium from the cell membrane with sodium, potassium, calcium pumps. And that separation of the positive charge from the negative charge actually creates an electrical spark, and that's what a neuronal depolarization is. So I started to think in these terms that, well, what if you have the wrong positive charges? What if you have lead instead of sodium, or lead instead of calcium? And it led me to research what other researchers have talked about, and it basically explained how a neuron can dysfunction, how a neuron or a neuronal mitochondria might fall apart, what would happen if the mitochondria fell apart, what then happens, what kind of oxidative stresses occur within the neuron, and all this was basically explained by neuroscientists. So the key was I learned how to measure it. And the second thing was I was curious to see if they were present, if these metals, these toxic metals, were present in my patients with idiopathic Parkinson's disease, idiopathic Alzheimer's disease. And lo and behold, I found very high levels of mercury, particularly, and lead in those patients. Almost always, that combination of mercury and lead are found in my Parkinson's patients. And so I started to remove it to see what would happen. And, I saw significant improvement in some of the clinical parameters, particularly in the cognitive function, in the alertness, in the speed of movement. And what's also very interesting is that I started to see that I was able to lower the dose of their medications. There's no question that Sinemet and levodopa will help the symptoms of a Parkinson's patients, but that is a relatively short-lived period of time, 5-6 years, and then they start getting further reductions in dopamine production. You have to increase the doses, and then you start seeing the side effects like dyskinesia. I was able to see an ability to lower the Sinemet dose and improve the dyskinesia and improve some of the other symptoms like psychosis. If you can give less medicine, I really tried to explain what I was doing, what I was seeing with some of the neuroscience. Why would I be able to lower the medication? Well, one of the reasons is probably able to produce some of their own dopamine, that these neurotoxic metals, if they disable the mitochondria of the neurons in the midbrain, they can reduce the production. And some of these metals you can attract out of the cell, and that would improve the mitochondrial function. Basically, just by trial and error, by looking to see what was in the patient, by using the FDA-approved treatment to remove those metals, chelation, I was able to see some clinical responses.
I am quite sure that a number of the listeners right now have probably had the test that you mentioned. They've had a blood test, they've had a urine analysis, and they've been told that they do not have any heavy metals in their body. You're saying that's not really going to reveal whether or not those heavy metals are there. So what is the best way to measure neurotoxic metals?
Right, and that's well established in the occupational health and environmental health literature. It's not necessarily established in the general medical literature. So I'm a normally trained doctor, board certified internist. I knew nothing about any of this literature. I was taught to measure it as a blood test and as a 24-hour urine collection. But when you look at some of the literature, when I went all the way back to 1950, 1960, in the 60s, the 70s, and the 50s, 60s, and 70s, there was a tremendous amount of research on heavy metal toxicity because of, you know, the pollution that we were dealing with. We had no thought about how toxic these metals were, even though we should have. I mean, there's hundreds of years of information on lead poisoning and mercury poisoning throughout the literature, but we put lead into gasoline. We put lead into paint. So people who worked in those factories got very sick. And, you know, battery factories, paint factories, people working in the petroleum industry got very, very sick. And because they were working every single day with lead or with other toxic metals, it was obvious why they got sick. Their blood lead level was high because they were exposed to it on a daily basis. When researchers would remove them from a factory, when doctors would remove them from a factory because their lead level was extremely high in the blood, because your blood level is going to tell you what you were exposed to within the past few days. And within days, it's going to be attracted into your bone or into your muscles or into your other cells. So it disappears from the blood. And researchers found that in the 60s and 70s that if you remove those patients from the industrial source of say, lead poisoning, for instance, that the lead would eventually disappear from the blood, but the patient didn't get better. And they would measure what was being excreted, and very little amounts were being excreted. So the conclusion was, well, these people are retaining the lead. Where are they retaining it? Biopsy studies then sought the source of, you know, where the lead was going, and most of it goes into bone. So when you take a calcium pill, you expect it to help fortify your bones. Well, how does it know to go into the bone? Well, it does. You know, the good Lord set it up properly. Your bones are made out of protein, and plenty of protein. And protein is negatively charged. And calcium, zinc, and magnesium are positively charged. 2+ positively charged calcium will be attracted into the negatively charged protein of your bones. So in the same fashion, lead and mercury and cadmium and aluminum are 2+ positively charged, aluminum being 3+ positively charged. They're going to be attracted into bone just like calcium will. So the researchers found that if you biopsy the bone and you analyze the bone, the majority of the lead went into the bone. And then that led to specific X-rays that could actually detect lead in bone. So there's an X-ray called K-shell X-ray fluorescence that was developed in the late 70s. And this is a special X-ray technique that can actually quantitate the lead content of your bone or the mercury content of your bone. So that led to the capability of studying it. So if you did an X-ray of this bone, and this X-ray is not widely available, it's available at research centers. There's a researcher at University of Michigan, Howard Hugh, who does a lot of X-ray fluorescence studies with lead, and there are people at Harvard who do it, and So there's three or four places around the country you can get this x-ray, and this x-ray can quantitate how much lead's in your shin bone, for instance. If you can quantitate how much lead and mercury is in the shin bone as opposed to calcium, and you watch those populations of people, you can see that those with the higher lead levels in their shin bone versus the lower lead levels get more neurodegenerative diseases. They get more dementia. They get more brain breakdown. They get more coronary disease. And these studies, there's several beautiful studies correlating lead and mercury content of bones. So the researchers showed that, well, these metals disappear from blood, and if they disappear from blood, they're not going to be excreted. So you're not going to find them in a blood test. You're not going to find them in a 24-hour urine collection, and that's the way they're screened by most doctors. And that's the way I screened for it until I discovered that there was a different way of measuring it. In the early 80s, of course, several other interesting metals started to evolve, like cadmium and aluminum and mercury, things that we were using in industry that were being placed in the environment. And obviously, if they're in the environment, we're going to absorb them through our food source and through the air. To try and get a better idea of how many different toxic metals were in bone and that were absorbed from the environment, a measurement was designed in 1983 called the EDTA, where you would give a chelator. Now, a chelator is a negatively charged protein that's more negatively charged. It's not necessarily a protein, but it acts like a protein. It's a negatively charged substance that is more negatively charged than the protein of your bone. So now the lead in that bone wants to leave the bone and go on to a greater negative charge because of a greater magnetic attraction. So a chelator was actually designed in the early 40s, 1940s, because of arsine gas, which is a poison gas that the Germans were using on the British and French troops. They were basically putting arsenic into a bomb. They were exploding the bomb. The soldiers would inhale the arsenic gas, and they would drop dead. And the autopsy studies would show, well, they're dying of arsenic. And the British, French, and American doctors were, basically perplexed as to what to do about this. And they called in the chemist and said, could you make a safe antidote for this, or we're all going to be speaking German soon? And they said, well, sure, we could. We could put a substance in the blood that would be more attractive to the arsenic than, say, the protein of the heart or the protein of the red blood cells. So they made the first human chelator called BAL, British anti-lewisite, and they would inject the soldiers, and that was an antidote for the arsenic. So as the arsenic was inhaled, it would be selectively attracted into the chelator. The chelator would bind it so that it couldn't interact with any other tissue, and then the kidney and liver would excrete it. So that was basically an antidote to arsine gas that occurred in 1941. And over the next decade, it was approved. Different chelators were approved by the FDA for lead poisoning and for mercury poisoning. Most of the clinical approaches to that were usually done in factory workers or people exposed at the workplace. So they had this steady exposure on a daily basis, so you would see it in the blood. But again, when you remove them from the factory, the levels of these metals would disappear. So researchers said, well, why don't we, if we take somebody out of a factory, and think of it in our case, we're not factory workers. We just grew up in America. So, I'm 60 years old now. I've inhaled lead for most of my life through automobile exhaust. My father smoked, so I inhaled secondhand cigarette smoke. Cigarettes they're grown in the soil, so it's tobacco that's grown in the soil. So it basically accumulates all the toxic metals that are in the soil are going to be in the tobacco plant, as they are in a tomato. But when you eat a tomato with lead and mercury and arsenic in it, your liver has natural chelators that can remove that. There are very important chelators in the liver that will detox our food and then excrete the metal through the intestines. One of the things that's missing in Parkinson's disease, one of the things I should say that is overly used and used up in Parkinson's disease, is called glutathione. And glutathione is a very natural chelator antioxidant that must be present in the cell that makes dopamine to neutralize the free radicals that occur with normal metabolism. And we find that in the substantia nigra, or the midbrain of Parkinson's patients, there is a relative absence of glutathione. And so that leaves the cells under distress. So when you eat a tomato, the lead and cadmium and arsenic and nickel that go into the liver, most of that is chelated by the liver cells and removed from the system. But if you inhale it through smoke or through the air or through a cigarette, then you don't have that defense. The lung doesn't have that defense. It's distributed from the lung into the blood, and it's in the and goes directly into bone and muscle. And then it basically stays there for decades. So when I grew up, I inhaled lead. Gas was basically leaded until 1990. So we inhaled lead up to that point on a daily basis. And that's why the lead levels in the 70s in children were very high, because of leaded gasoline. That's why gas was unleaded. But the problem with what happens to that lead is it doesn't leave the body. Most of it goes into bone. So bone becomes the major source for lead and mercury. And basically, the lead and mercury displaces calcium from the bone, and it stays there until something happens to the bone. So it may stay there for decades. And when something happens to the bone, if you break a bone, if you lose the bone because of aging and osteoporosis, if you have surgery on a bone, you're going to release whatever is in that bone into the general circulation. And some of those metals will find access to the central nervous system. So your bone kind of sacrifices itself by attracting these metals, and these metals will displace calcium from the bone. But when something happens to the bone, that's when it transfers to the brain. And that's what happens with aging, because as you age, you start to lose bone. And when you lose bone, the lead and the mercury in the bone gets released and can seed the central nervous system. Researchers in the early 80s said, well, we want to sample what's in the bone, and we certainly can't biopsy everybody's bones. So why don't we use the method of removing the metals? The method approved by the FDA was chelation. If you have lead poisoning or mercury poisoning, you would chelate that person to remove those heavy metals to try and improve their lot. Well, they said, why don't we chelate somebody? Why don't we give the chelator intravenously and or orally and attract the metal out of the bone and the muscle onto the chelator, and then the liver and kidney will immediately excrete it. So they collected the urine immediately after the chelation, and they found that there was a huge amount of lead and mercury coming out of the body from the removal process. So that was adopted as a method of measurement. Basically, in occupational medicine, someone is in a factory, someone gets high blood pressure and kidney failure, which are known to be caused by lead and mercury, they would be removed from the factory, the levels would be reduced in the blood, but they would still be in the bone and muscle and kidney, so they would chelate that person. Then, after the chelation, immediately collect the urine for 24 hours and measure how much lead came out. And that became pretty much the standard way of measuring heavy metals, is to measure it after a chelation. That method of measurement was basically sort of approved by that community in 1988. Somebody like you and I, we don't work in a factory. I had very little exposure except what was in the environment, but very small amounts of this slowly coming in is going to be attracted into bone. So if I inhaled lead growing up, if I inhaled mercury growing up, certainly I've been exposed to cigarette smoke and to the dust, you know, in my community. If lead and cadmium and nickel, arsenic and aluminum are placed in the environment, which they certainly are, because if you analyze the soil, you find them there. And on a dusty day, I inhale some, not enough to show up as a huge amount in my blood, but most of that metal is attracted into my bone. And so over many years, I slowly accumulate a significant amount of those metals in my bone. And then when something happens to my bone, as I age, if I fracture it, that's when these metals are released into the general circulation. And that particular research has been quite well done by someone named Ellen Silvergeld at Johns Hopkins. She was at the University of Maryland for many, many years. I should give them credit. And now she's at Johns Hopkins, I believe. And she has published some very interesting papers showing how lead, for instance, slowly accumulates from the environment. Small amounts show up in the blood, but most of it is attracted into bone. And then the bone becomes a source for later toxicity of the brain. So there's one particular paper that I found very interesting called Lead in Bone, which was in the Journal for Neurotoxicology in 1993. And she described this mechanism, how lead will slowly biologically accumulate in the bone. And then when something happens to the bone, it'll be released into the central nervous system. And then once lead gets into the central nervous system, once lead gets into your brain, it just creates a tremendous array of toxicity for the neuron. What's fascinating to me is how some patients with fairly high amounts of lead in their bone will selectively attract that into the midbrain and develop Parkinson's disease, and some other patients will selectively attract it into, say, the frontal lobe and develop dementia. And that has somewhat to do with our genetics. There's a lot of genetic links that are appearing with Parkinson's disease and with Alzheimer's disease that might explain why, if you have lead in your bone, for instance, it's attracted into your substantia nigra or your midbrain, and you develop a degeneration of that area of the brain versus someone else who might not even attract it into the brain and never develop dementia, or someone who will attract it into a different area of the brain. There's a lot of plausible explanation as to why that would occur. You know, you could see how excited I got once I knew how to measure it, and once I found that there was a tremendous amount of literature that showed the proper measurement. The name of the measurement is called post-provocation. You provoke the metal to come out of the bone and muscle with the chelator. And then after giving the chelator, as the metals start to come out of the bone and muscle and get attracted to the chelator, which is how you would remove the metals if you were poisoned by them with chelation, you do a chelation and then you collect the urine for 24 hours and have it analyzed, and then you can see a big difference. You can see a tremendous difference in what's in that bone. And that type of measurement called post-provocation is basically termed measuring the body burden for heavy metals. And that's really something that several physician organizations have been studying. There are two major physician organizations, one called the American College for the Advancement of Medicine, ACAM, and the American College for the Integrative Medicine, ISTEM. Those are MD organizations that have studied how to measure this, what doses of the chelator to use safely if these metals are present. They've kind of led the way into bringing up to this exciting new area of measuring things that contribute to neurodegenerative disorders.
People listening to this conversation may be now thinking, hey, I really ought to get this post-provocation test. And I'm thinking to myself, well, no, I didn't work in a paint factory, but I certainly liked to smell fuel when I was a teenager when it was being put into the car. If I were to go to your clinic, explain for everyone exactly what would happen with this test. Would you give me an IV first, this chelation IV? Or would shot? Or
yes, it's an IV. Now, there are milder forms of measurement, but if you don't give enough of the chelator to attract the metal out, you're going to underestimate what we find. So there is an oral chelator that was approved for children in 1990 for lead poisoning and for mercury poisoning or toxicity. And that definition is really under question. You know, what constitutes lead toxicity? Well, the public health department says you should have a certain level of lead in your blood over, say, 60 or 70 micrograms, for instance. But that doesn't hold water. Researchers have shown that even within the so-called reference range for lead, which is 0 to 10 micrograms in your blood, there is significant toxicity, particularly in children. Attention deficit syndrome, learning disabilities, behavioral problems have been found within levels between, say, 3 and 6 micrograms of lead in the blood of a child. A lot of this work done by Harold Needleman at the University of Pittsburgh, originally published a paper in 1979 in the New England Journal of Medicine showing that he could predict classroom behavior and IQ based on how much lead was in the baby teeth, because teeth like bone would attract lead. And he found that, you know, the blood lead levels are unreliable. So basically, what you can do in children in particular is you can give some oral chelating pills for 4 or 5 days based on their body weight and based on an FDA formula for removing lead. I think at this point the FDA frowns a little bit on chelation. I'm not quite sure why. They certainly approved it for lead toxicity, but I think because the definition of lead toxicity is based on blood lead level, there's a little bit of friction among physicians who chelate and physicians who don't know about chelation, because they're feeling that doctors are chelating inappropriately because the blood lead level isn't high enough. But the research clearly shows that it's an unreliable marker as to measure it in the blood. So you have to give a significant amount of the chelator to pull out enough metal to then collect the urine to measure it. So the protocols that have been developed by the International College of Integrative Medicine and the American College for Advanced Medicine calls for using around 3 grams of EDTA intravenously, which appears to be extremely safe. You know, the doses that were approved by the FDA are much higher than that, and if you use the very high levels, you can overwhelm the kidney and create problems. But that doesn't seem to occur at three grams, and certainly doesn't occur with 1 gram. There are many studies that used chelation in chronic kidney failure patients in the 80s and sort of decided upon the safe dose to use. So, you know, basically the doses are relatively safe that we use, but what I usually like to do is give the oral chelator for 4 days and then do an intravenous EDTA provocation where you give it intravenously. That starts attracting the metal out, and you immediately collect the urine. And I also like to collect the bowel movement, because the liver does most of the detoxing, and I find that if I just measure the urine, I'll miss some of the toxic metals that come out of the liver, particularly mercury. Mercury is heavily excreted through the liver into the intestines, and so I like to collect the urine and a bowel movement and have those analyzed. And it's always a good idea to check the urine and the bowel movement and the blood before chelating, so that you'll see that there really isn't anything being excreted. That's called a pre-provocation measurement. And then you chelate, and then you collect the urine and the stool afterwards, and you can see the difference. You can see how much more metal is coming out of the body being attracted out by the chelator. So, yes, the measurement is an intravenous infusion of the chelator and then a collection of the urine and, in my case, the stool. That still hasn't gained favor yet, but I presented some data recently at a conference in Minnesota, called an Eye Mosaic Conference. It was a joint conference for all the integrative medicine conferences, and I showed some data how stool measurements are really important for 3 very toxic metals that I find in my Parkinson's and Alzheimer's patients. Mercury, bismuth, and tungsten are very neurotoxic metals that I find in practically all of my patients with neurodegenerative disorders. So it is an intravenous infusion and then collection of the specimens. It's the only way to tell, other than biopsying the bone and having it analyzed for several different metals, and that's just not practical. And that provocation, you know, in my experience, is very safe to do.
Would your explanation then suggest that our bones and muscles are an exposure source for neurodegenerative diseases like Parkinson's?
Absolutely. You know, that's, when you think of it, Robert, probably everyone listening knows someone who's probably over 65 who fractured a hip. This is a good forum to get this point across, because I don't think it's considered. I know what's in the hip bone now because I've measured it in several thousand people. So I know what metals are in the bone. I know that these metals are primarily in bone because bone attracts most of the mineral. when you fracture a bone, you release this metal into the general circulation. Some of it is going to seed the central nervous system. Some of it is going to be absorbed by the heart. Some of it is going to be absorbed by the kidney. So it's the fracture causes a sudden release. So everyone knows someone who's fractured a hip and died within a two-year period or went downhill tremendously. Pretty close to national statistics across the board. I know certainly in several of the hospitals that I deal with that when you fracture a hip, when you have an older person over 65 who fractures a hip, and you follow them over a two-year period, 50%, half of those people are dead in a two-year period. And they die from apparently unrelated disorders like heart attack, stroke, dementia, pneumonia, God knows what. But they die nonetheless after a fracture. So there's a tremendous deterioration in health after a bone fracture. Well, you have to ask your question, why? Well, what's in the bone? Well, you can tell what's in the bone with this provocation test. Studies have shown, dating back 30 years, that if you do these X-ray techniques that can detect these metals, that you see there's a significant quantity of these heavy metals in bone. The bone becomes a source for disease later on. There's a very interesting study 2 years ago in the journal called Circulation, which is the American Heart Association's major journal. This was by Howard Hugh, that's H-U, Dr. Howard Hugh's group at Harvard. Dr. Howard Hugh is a major researcher on bone lead and toxicity of other organs. And Dr. Hugh has done several studies for the Veterans Affairs Normative Aging Study. And he's published over 230 research papers on what we're talking about today, on how lead gets absorbed into bone, and then from bone it transfers to other organs, and that bone lead is the major culprit for eventual disease. So Dr. Hugh's group in Boston at Harvard, they did this very special X-ray called K-shell X-ray fluorescence, which could quantitate the amount of lead in your shin bone. And they took 1,000 veterans from Boston who were relatively healthy at the time. They did this X-ray of the bone to quantitate the lead content of bone. They found, as they would in us, there was no occupational exposures. These were normal citizens. They just grew up in America, grew up during the era of leaded gasoline, and paint, lead and paint, etc. So they had the same exposures we did. They found that in these 1,000 veterans that they quantitated lead content, some of them had a very high lead content in their shin bones, and some of them had very little. And again, that difference is explainable, why somebody would retain more lead in their bones and somebody else would excrete it. Some people have better excretion potential. Some people have better detoxing potential than others. So if your potential is not that good, you're going to retain more of these metals from the environment in your system. So they took these 1,000 veterans. They compared those who had the highest one-third for lead in their bone, the top tertile, they called it, and they compared them to the bottom one-third. So if you had the highest one-third for lead in your bone compared to those of these 1,000 veterans that had the lowest one-third, they compared those two populations over a 10-year period. They found that heart attack death rate was 6 times higher in the category of people who had the highest lead amount in their shin bone versus those with the lowest. There was a 3 to 4 higher cancer death rate in the top tertile for lead versus the lower tertile for lead. So death from all causes were increased depending on the bone lead concentration. Now, that paper was published in the journal Circulation in September of 2009. I haven't heard any reaction to that paper, but that was a huge confirmation into what I thought was going on and what Ellen Silvergeld has said for years, that these metals get sequestered in bone and then that becomes a source for the other organs. That makes it easier to explain. So if heart attack and cancer and dementia and neurodegenerative disorders are more likely to occur depending on the heavy metal content of your bone, certainly the bone becomes a source for the other organs. And I thought that research was fascinating.
It is fascinating.